Hello, and welcome to Podcast to Be Named Later, the official podcast of OutfieldFlyRule.com. I'm Brent Blackwell, here with Chris Jervis.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking a little about recent Braves news, of which there is none. We'll be talking a little bit about the DH as well, and we'll be taking a look at Braves, first baseman, the shape of the organization in terms of first base position. Here in the third episode, episode number three. I got to get used to doing that at the beginning. All right, thanks for joining us. So, Chris, not a lot going on with the Braves right now.
Not much Braves news out there. I think the biggest Braves news this week is that Yenis Cespedes signed with the New York Mets.
Yes.
He re-signed with the Mets. Took a little bit less money to do so. The higher average annual value, he makes, I think it was 3 years, $75 million deal. 1 year opt-out. If he leaves after the first year, he can make 27 and a half. But he wanted to stay in New York. He took less money to stay in New York. There was an offer on the table from the Nationals for 5 years, 100 plus million. His team had reached out to the Yankees as well just to see if there was interest from them so that he could stay in New York. He's a solid player. Don't really want to. I would have preferred had he gone to the AL.
Yeah.
But it is what it is.
Yeah, he's not. I mean, he had a great second half of the year last year, but I don't think he's. I can understand why New York didn't want to give him more than 3 years. He's a risky player with a history of bad on base percentage.
Right. He that run that he had with the Mets last year when he got traded to the Mets was just unreal. It was crazy. It was a 45 home run a season pace, and he's not a 45 home run a season guy. He hit 36 last year, driven by that incredible run that he had with the Mets, and that's just not going to happen again.
Right. It's a good move for New York to keep him though in the lineup because they need some power.
And he's a functional player. I think that his playing center field for them is going to be an experiment. He's not a particularly good center fielder. What's funny is he's a very, very good left fielder. Put him in left and he's a top shelf guy. You put him in center and it's like putting my fat self out there.
So they don't have a center fielder. Well, what happened to Lagares?
Lagares is going to be a late inning defensive replacement.
So they've got Conforto and who's in right? Duda?
Duda's at first base. In right, I'm not sure. Lagares is going to be on the bench.
They still got Granderson.
They got Granderson in right. And they also went out this offseason inside Deaza. They actually were not really interested in Cespedes because it had been made known that he was looking for a 5-year deal. They weren't interested in going for 5 years for Cespedes.
Right.
So they went out and signed Deaza. And now they have quite a few outfielders.
Yeah, and no center fielder.
Right.
Well, I guess they do have center fielders. They just aren't good enough to start.
They could probably move Granderson back to center field. But my understanding from a couple of articles is that Cespedes doesn't want to play right field. He'd rather play center left. So, you know, it'll be musical chairs out there.
I'd rather play center field too, but it doesn't mean I get to. So sometimes you have to do what you can do, not what you want to do. Also, I guess linked to the Cespedes news is the fact that Washington made him an offer, and he did not sign with Washington, despite them offering more years and more total money, which is similar to what happened with Jason Hayward, I believe, also. So it's an interesting trend this year. The Nationals are not landing big free agents that they're pursuing, despite offering them more years and more money. There was some recent talk on the Outfield Fly Rule Facebook page about is there any underlying reason why players may not be going towards Washington, or is it?
There might have been some talk. There was some people thinking that maybe the clubhouse atmosphere had something to do with it. Perhaps it was Dusty Baker. Chris Hayes from the Outfield Fly Rule page, and also he runs a page on Facebook called Brave Support Group, made a good point. Dusty Baker's always been considered a player's manager. Mm-hmm. His players have always liked him. So I don't think it's that. It's probably Washington saw some success with some deferred compensation deals last year, especially with Max Scherzer, where probably a full third of the deal, I think, was deferred well into later in his life.
It's a lot.
They may have presented similar options to Cespedes and Hayward and Zobrist and other guys that they lost out on, and those players were probably not interested in doing that. This was their first big payday. They wanted the big payday. Scherzer had already been paid before. The other thing is that in the case of Hayward and Zobrist, they were pretty clear in their desire that the Cubs were one of the teams they wanted to play for. So, you know, I think they had – money's always going to be the motivating factor for a player.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're getting similar deals, then you go to factor number two, factor number three. In the case of Zobrist, Chicago's not that terribly far away from home, and he has a newborn. So, you know, that factored into his decisions. There's a lot of things that go into it. I don't think much should be made of the fact that the Nationals didn't get who they went after.
I think a lot of it also is the opt-out, because players tend to bet on themselves heavily when given the opportunity, especially younger players or players who, well, I don't know if you would, how old is Cespedes?
30.
Okay. He's not exactly a young player, but he's not old either. He's not, he doesn't, in his mind, he's not running out of time in right. the big leagues, so he doesn't need to take... He doesn't have to take guaranteed money. He can opt out after 1 year and hit the market when he's 31 and still...
He'll get a four-year, five-year deal, maybe.
If he thinks the second half of the season was real and he can continue that for 2016, then he can get the five-, six-year deal at $30 million a year.
Sure, and
whatever that he wants.
His team may have pointed out to him that next year's free agent class is pretty weak from in terms of hitters. So he can go ahead, get the one big, huge average annual salary this year, opt out, get back into the market next year, and do a four-year deal for another, you know, $100 million, you know, possibly 4 years, $100. There he gets his $100 million plus the $27 that he got from the Mets this year. It turns out to be a better deal than what he would have signed with the Nationals.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything from Cespedes and Hayward that suggests that they dislike Washington or anything, because Hayward got two opt-outs, which are... really favorable to him.
Sure.
But I think in the case of Zobrist, maybe the case could be made because he's older and this is probably his last
shot at it.
Big contract. It's definitely his last big contract. And he chose Chicago over Washington specifically. And it's hard to blame him. Chicago is the favorite right now, probably to win the National League.
Right.
But anyway, that's interesting. I don't think it's that he doesn't want to play for Dusty Baker or anything, but
obviously the Papelbon Harper incident at the end of the year last year, you know, that's fresh on people's mind, but players know stuff like that sometimes happens in dugouts. They've seen it, they've been involved in it. You know, I don't know how much of that is a factor.
I know Washington traded Drew Storen. Is Papelbon still in Washington?
I believe he is.
That should be fun to watch this year. That's something I would not have predicted would have been the case at the end of last season. If you could let me pick one player off Washington's roster that would not be on the team in 2016, I would have picked Papelbon. And
Storen has kind of been hosed all the way around several times by Washington now. He was the closer, and they demoted him so that they could bring in Papelbon, who they picked up his option rather than offering Storen more money. They made Papelbon the closer. All of this was done before they even acquired him, while Storen was still the closer for them. It's almost they just publicly took a dump on him.
Papelbon also had the requirement that he be the closer.
Yes,
like he has to. It's the Bob Wickman requirement, which is, you know, that sort of thing never flew under Bobby Cox, which is Wickman. I love the story of Wickman complaining about being brought in a non-save situation. And then the next headline, like 3 hours later, was Braves release Bob Wickman. Just, it was like he complained at like 10:30 p.m. one night and then was cut by 1 a.m. It was immediate. It was fantastic.
Well, Papelbon was effective for Washington. Wickman was not effective for Atlanta.
Yeah. So that's really weird. That's a strange choice they made. Who did they get for... Do you remember who they got for Storen? They traded him to Toronto, right?
Yes. And
Ben Revere?
I don't recall. I can look that up.
Okay. We can get it to it later. It's fine. We'll probably do a podcast closer to opening day. Maybe that looks at the rest of the National League East, so I won't have to guess at these things like I've been doing
like we're
today.
Doing now.
Right. We did show prep for this.
Just not on these
just
things.
Just not on these things. We're 9 minutes in and we're already talking about things that that we were not prepared to talk about. The other interesting thing that's people are talking about a little bit today is talk of the strike zone being altered, the rule book strike zone.
Yes, I did not read on that too much other than the one article that was linked last night. I know that last week, and this kind of dovetails with the main topic today, Rob Manfred presented several options to the Players Association last week or 10 days ago regarding ways to increase offense in this era of a down offense. We've been on a declining offense trend for about 5 years now, although it ticked up a little bit slightly in the second half last year.
Right.
Some of the ideas that they presented were changes to the strike zone, lowering the pitcher's mound, which, good Lord, I don't know what would happen if that. They'd be throwing from a flat plane at that point. But lowering the pitcher's mound. They also talked, obviously, about the NLDH, tightly winding the ball, winding it more tightly. Different things that can contribute to offense. And one of the things that was presented was the strike zone being altered a little bit. I believe in the last few years you were looking at it, and it's roughly the same area is being called in terms of the amount of space is being called. It's just shifted downward several inches.
Yeah, I know there's been a downward shift in the called strike zone. And when I say called strike zone, that I'm just saying the way it's called, not necessarily what it is. But the strike zone right now calls for the strike zone to extend down to just below the kneecap. And I think it's being called probably a couple inches lower than that consistently. Pitchers get low strikes all the time, and they don't get high strikes, so a lot of people don't really mind, but it's I think it has contributed to the decline in offense because players are having to swing at those pitches down, and it's creating more ground balls than ever, and swings and misses. And I think more offense would be good for baseball. You don't have to return to 1999's offensive totals, or 2000 I think was the year that it was off the charts, but you don't have to necessarily return to that. But at the same time, I think it'd be better for the game to have more offense.
The strike zone over the last 15 years or so, and this has primarily occurred with moving the umpires around from being strictly AL-NL to calling games regardless of what league they're in. Mm-hmm. The strike zone has been squashed a little bit. It's now gone from, you know, you rarely see anything above the belt called a strike any longer.
No.
And it used to be that, you know, if it was near the shoulders, it would be called a strike. Now, it's got to be basically between the belt and just below the knees. But the strike zone is also widened to a couple of inches off of either side of the plate, especially the left-handers.
Yeah.
Lefties get the low and away to left-handed batters is called consistently off the plate. Is that good or bad? Don't know. That's just what has developed over the years. I know with Questech and some of the other things, that was supposed to have been corrected. And ultimately, it gets back to umpires are human and humans are infallible. They can't see everything perfectly every time.
Yeah, and there's a movement among some baseball fans for robot umpires. But I actually don't want robot umpires just because I love pitch framing. And catchers would no longer be able to frame pitches if the umps all knew exactly what they were doing on every pitch.
It gives a human element to the game. I think you don't have to go to an automated system.
Yeah.
You can just be more consistent with the system that's in place. Go back to calling what's actually dictated in the rule book.
Yeah, you introduce technology when the human element is so flawed that it can't produce good results. But for the most part, I think baseball, the strike zone is well called generally. It's just dipped low. And
right.
So they're trying to correct that by putting it at the top of the kneecaps, or at least there's talk. There's talk that they could try to raise it to the top of the kneecaps, which would probably actually just, in effect, what it would do is just get it called the way the rule book says it is now, which is you'll still see balls called around the bottom of the kneecap, just not at the shin anymore. So they're adjusting the perspective more than anything.
Yeah, digging out that ball out of the dirt for the batter now becomes a little bit less of a project when you can actually reach the pitch being thrown to you.
Right. So I think it doesn't sound like a bad idea to me. Although it feels like they're always altering these judgment rules in baseball where umps have to relearn everything about the, you know, it's easy to learn a new rule, but it's hard to I would imagine it'd be hard for an umpire to relearn the strike zone or to relearn, you know, different aspects of the game like that, that where it always requires judgment and reflex and that sort of thing.
I remember you and I had a friend who's no longer with us who was an umpire, and he used to talk about the perspective that umpires had, where they had to set up to be able to see everything. Mm-hmm. And he often thought that the perspective on where an umpire sets up changes how he views the strike zone. Yeah. He's calling what he sees from his perspective.
Right.
But if you look at a game, the umpire isn't set up directly behind the plate. He's set up over the right or left shoulder of the catcher, so he's already off center of the ball being thrown anyway.
Right.
And he said that sometimes that affects the view. He says, you think you call it, and then you go back and look, and you look at a replay, and you're like, oh, man, I was way off of that. You know, I don't know if there's a way to correct that, because you can't line up directly behind the catcher and be able to see well enough to make a call, I don't think.
And that goes into, we talked about pitch framing last week, and that's another thing that catchers do is they take advantage of which angle the good pitch framers at least take advantage of the angle the ump is looking at, and they frame it so that it looks more like a strike from his angle. I know that's something that Jose Molina would always do.
Right, he would always turn his body to get, you know, the maximum exposure, mm-hmm. or sometimes to block out the ump so that he could see just the glove and not the actual ball.
Right. All right. Well, that's pretty much it. There's like I said, there's not much going on.
Yeah, slow news cycle right now.
Since the last podcast, Justin Upton has signed with the Tigers. Any thoughts on that? Just
he received pretty much what I kind of expected him. Maybe $1 million a year, $1.5 million less.
Yeah.
But I think Upton's going to do well. I mean, there's a large contingent of Braves fans that don't like Justin Upton. They thought he was too streaky. They thought that he was too inconsistent. That's the way power hitters are. Upton, for all of his streakiness and inconsistency, regularly put up good on-base percentages. Much, much higher than, you know, they're the same people who called Justin Upton streaky and inconsistent were calling for Yenis Cespedes, who has a on-base percentage 50 points lower.
Right.
And is not as good a power hitter and strikes out just as often, slightly less than Upton. But anything that is good about Cespedes, Upton does better.
Yeah.
And I just didn't understand the dichotomy between the two. But, you know, good for Justin. He got his big paycheck, and he was one that if there was a way that we could have made the numbers work for the salary, I wouldn't mind having him back.
Yeah, I always liked Justin Upton. I'm happy he's not going to a team that I hate, I guess.
Right.
I think he'll age well. I think he'll be a good power hitter for the next few years because he was up really young, right? He was good at a very young age right. in the majors, which is rare. Those players tend to age well.
And he's got a shot to get a ring in the next couple of years. Mike Ilitch of the Tigers, the owner of the Tigers, is spending every dollar he has right now. He's 86 or 89 years
old.
And he wants a ring before he checks out. And he's spending everything he has. Every Little Caesars you see is going to go up. The price is going to go up just so that he can get a ring. So, good for Justin Upton. He's going to have a ring here soon, possibly, and he got his payday.
Yeah, so just remember, when you get those $5 hot and ready pizzas from Little Caesars, you may be helping Justin Upton get his World Series ring.
Today's podcast brought to you by Little Caesars Pizza.
Yeah. Actually, no, because we would have to charge for that. All right, so the third thing that's been a little discussed lately, I guess the fourth thing, I forgot Upton, but the fourth thing that's been discussed lately is DH. The DH annual DH talk has cropped up in Major League Baseball. DH to the National League. First of all, the DH is not leaving the American League. So if you're holding out that the Major League Baseball will wipe the DH off the American League books, not going to happen. It will not happen in my lifetime, I predict.
And the flip side to that is it's pretty likely that the DH will come to the NL. The question is when and how will it be implemented?
Yeah.
This talk kind of started last week with an article from, I think it was CBS Sports, did something online where, again, getting back to the Rob Manfred, when he presented the proposals to the Players Association for ways to increase offense, one of those things was to bring the DH to the NL. And he said it could happen by 2017. Now, he was just speaking to a group of people, some reporters took that, ran with it, and suddenly could happen became the DH will be in the NL by 2017. That's not what he said. He was just presenting proposals, and folks took it and ran with it.
Right.
Will the DH in the NL be a good thing? Have no idea. All I want is for the two sides to play by the same rules. For the simple reason being that I'm a Braves fan. I want what's best for the Braves. And right now, the Braves are essentially down a man on a roster because they have to carry a guy like Ramiro Pena instead of a guy like David Ortiz simply because we have to, in the NL, swap out a pitcher at some point during the game.
Yeah, it's I definitely understand wanting to play by the same rules. First of all, I do not want to see the DH implemented in the National League until Bartolo Colon's career is over. I want that lovely large man to get as many times into the batter's box as possible before we call it, before we change it.
I can be on board with that.
But there's just too much comedy that we'd be throwing away to ask someone to bat for Bartolo Colon. But there are different aspects of it. There's the aesthetic aspect of it's nice to have the same nine players that are in the field be the same nine who are hitting, and I get that. But at the same time, in the National League, or rather in the American League, all nine players are creating good plate appearances against the pitcher. You're getting better high quality on a at-bat to at-bat basis in the American League, because in the National League, the ninth player, so 11% of the plate appearances until he gets taken out at least, are pretty much foregone conclusions. It takes a rare thing for it not to be a foregone conclusion, and that foregone conclusion is strikeout or weakly hit ball.
Right,
and it does lessen the competition when that's the case.
And for me, it reduces the enjoyment of the game because I know that I now have a few minutes that I can flip over from the game, flip over from the Braves game, and you know, if my options are watching, Williams Perez hit, and 3 minutes of the Big Bang Theory, I'm going to take the Big Bang Theory, and I'm not a big fan of the show, so that should give you an idea of where I fall on that spectrum. Pitchers are not good. Even the best hitting pitchers are outliers, just like the best hitting hitters are outliers. Mm-hmm. When you take the group as a whole, they are just tremendously bad.
Yeah, they're really bad.
And there really is no reason why the two leagues should compete on a different playing field. And as you mentioned, the DH and the AL is not going away. People think of it as this new gimmick. It's not a gimmick. It's been around for a third of the existence of the game.
Yeah.
It's been around longer than free agents have been around. So it's not something that's gimmicky and we're just going to test this and it's going away. The DH is here. It's here to stay. The question is there going to be more DHs in the case of adding it to the NL? But, yeah, pitchers are not good as a group.
Did you have numbers on
that? Oh, yeah. I think I was going to ask you some of these. From 1960 to 2015, so we're talking the last, 55 years?
56 years, yeah.
Pitchers as an average over that period of time, 354 OPS.
Oof.
That's hideous. That's horrible. That's, B.J. Upton did better than that while he was here in Atlanta.
Yeah.
I think. Maybe. I'm going with that.
Oh yeah, but, he had
he had a 270 on base percentage.
His on base was almost there anyway. There's no way he OPS
354 OPS for the average on base percentage for a pitcher over that period of time, 188. That means they got on base less than 19% of the time.
Yeah.
It's an automatic out. There's no reason to keep running them up there. When at the end of the season, you're going to have to face a team that doesn't have that option. I'm not saying that the NLDH is better. I'm saying that I want my team to have a chance to compete. And when they're running David Ortiz out there at DH and we're running Nick Swisher, 2016 version, yeah. Nick Swisher out there at DH, we're at a competitive disadvantage.
Right. And there's from a team building standpoint, it's, we would, if we played each other in a game, we'd be playing under the same rules. There is that. But at the same time, the Red Sox know they're going to need David Ortiz for 150 games this year.
Right.
And Atlanta can't make a signing like that just for the four games that will... Well, I guess there's, what, maybe a...
Figure there's 18 interleague games.
Okay.
And so, four postseason games.
So at most 22 games, you're right. going to need a DH.
And you can't structure...
Actually, no. Some of the interleague games will be at home.
Right.
So you're talking less than 15 games a year. So Atlanta just can't justify having a DH, a pure hitter, like an Edgar Martinez or a David Ortiz, but Boston can. Seattle could back in the day. And so that's why it's difficult, and that's why American League teams would have an advantage like that. I guess there's an argument that the National League would have, but the advantages just aren't the same. The National League would have maybe a deeper bullpen, is that...
They would have probably an extra effective arm. The NL has an extra arm in the bullpen that's more of a swingman type.
Yeah.
You can pick up and go, you know, four, five, six innings, or to be a spot emergency starter. But
so what would you rather have, a spot emergency starter or David Ortiz in the World Series? Which one of those would be more helpful?
Because we're already, I mean, and that's the point, because our roster is structured, you know, we're going to have three pitchers, three primary starters in the postseason. So that leaves our two starters from our rotation available for use either out of the bullpen or in emergency situations or long relief. So we're doubling up on something we already have.
Right.
And we don't have the player that we can use to bring up for the offensive support. I mean, Joey Tardasovich, who is no longer with us, that would have been a DH option for us in the past.
And in the National League, versatility is stressed, and you typically surrender some offense to get versatility.
Correct.
Defensive versatility. So
Ramiro Pena, great example. He's a good player, but he's not.
Where is he now?
I'm going to go with Venezuela. I don't know.
Yeah. Hopefully listening. Hope you're doing well, Ramiro Pena.
I always liked him. He just reached a point where he couldn't hit left-handed.
Yeah.
Hitting. But one of the arguments for the DH, too, is that the strategy is different between the two leagues. Mm-hmm. And that was the case for a short while as they were learning what the differences are. But it all boils down to, if you have a guy who can handle a bat professionally, then you have more options strategically with that guy. Even to right now, to the point, the way the NL clubs structure their day-to-day workouts and their day-to-day routines and their day-to-day practices, pitchers get 15 shots at trying to bunt a ball.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they'll get a few swings so that they can show off to their pitching buddies that they can hit the long ball. But even the NL clubs, pitching is such a specialized mm-hmm. Profession that even the NL clubs have pretty much punted on pitchers being hitters.
Right.
And they even structure the pitchers' workouts to be primarily pitching related. They don't even care about pitchers. So if you don't care about it, then let's at least put that batter back into the lineup.
Right. You almost have to just do it on your own time.
Right.
If you want.
But the strategy is one of the biggest arguments that we see. And from what I've seen, just a little bit that I've seen, the strategy seems to actually occur more often in the American League than it does in the NL.
It depends on what kind of strategy you're talking about. Fans of the National League, the current National League style, you always hear strategy, National League strategy, can't beat that National League strategy. And there is one specific situation where National League makes it difficult for managers, and it requires good strategic decisions, and that is when a starting pitcher is doing well enough to where you consider leaving him in the game, and he comes to the bat, you know, with
one run game,
tie game, and two outs, and you have to decide:
do I get my run here,
right,
or do I leave my pitcher in to continue pitching effectively?
And that is a hard decision, and that it does require good strategy, and it makes for good drama, but it also doesn't happen that often.
Right.
I mean, those are a very specialized situation where it probably comes up with a single pitcher. How many times a year do you think? Maybe 5 times a year?
8? 10 maybe? Still.
Got to be less than 10 unless he's really good.
Right.
Last
year, Shelby Miller would have been an example. And
yeah.
It reached a point where they just... our options were so bad just among regular players. We're not even considering pinch hitting options.
Yeah.
Just regular players were so bad last year that it finally reached a point where Freddie just decided to leave Shelby Miller in and take the loss rather than trying to go and get the one run. But even with Shelby Miller last year, it did not happen that often. And he was a guy who pitched effectively for the bulk of the year and would find himself in a situation where a decision had to be made. Do we pull Shelby Miller, who's pitching pretty well, or do we try and go for a run? Even with him last year, it didn't happen that often.
Right. And in that case, it's the National League strategy, the current National League, the no DH strategy is fun to watch. But in pretty much all other forms of strategy.
Offensive strategy, anyway.
Offensive strategy, it's a little more interesting in the American League. You have more freedom. You have more freedom, and it allows more variety from manager to manager. In the National League, the book is kind of written for you, except in that situation we just talked about. Pitchers bunt with you know, a runner on first and nobody out.
A runner on base.
Right, a runner on base, nobody out. The pitcher bunts. The pitcher always bunts. That's not strategy. It's done for you. You know what to do. There's a, you know, double switches after you pinch hit for a pitcher. It's kind of done for you. Most National League managers manage similarly in terms of those decisions that are associated with the DH. But when you're not tethered to that strategy, when you're not tethered to having to do certain things because of a pitcher being in the lineup, you have more freedom, and that manifests in the decisions American League managers make, which is, let me move here. By the way, I had no internet today, so I had to take paper notes. Yeah, so this is old school podcasting right here, which is funny.
Brent has a cheat sheet.
Because there's no such thing as old school podcasting. But all right, so bunting with position players, so bunting with non-pitchers, sacrifice bunts. Last year, National League teams did that 283 times.
And that's traditionally considered a National League thing. You have your eight-hole hitter sacrifice a guy over, get him into scoring position, and then you have a pinch hitter come up for the pitcher to drive him in. Works every time.
Right. Now, we won't get into the actual strategy behind sacrifice bunts. I actually prefer my team not to use position players to sack bunt, but it's an aspect of strategy, whether it's good or bad, and National League teams did it 283 times last year. American League teams, 429 times.
American League teams used the sacrifice with a position player more times last year.
Yes.
Sounds like strategy.
Significantly more.
I wonder if that's because the batter that they have to use there can handle the bat. Because at that point, you have a position player batting ninth.
Yeah. Well, you have,
and he's a guy who's accustomed to handling a bat. It may be poorly, but he's accustomed to handling
a bat. You got more professional hitters in the lineup in that case. So you can maybe make the, or at least I guess in their heads, you can make the case for using one. Whereas in the National League, you're hesitant to do that because you're already got an automatic out in the lineup that you have to account for.
So you're giving away an out, and then you have the automatic out coming up. So now you've got that runner over to third, but now there's two outs. You can't get him in.
Right. All right. Second thing is swings with the runner going.
Basically a hit and run.
Hit and run. National League ball.
NL stat. 1985 St. Louis Cardinals, which was a great team, by the way.
I will preface this. The National League did lead in this stat last year. It was virtually a tie. 4,220 swings with a runner in motion in the National League. 41-45 in the American League. So it's a difference of, what are we looking at? 75 swings between league to league last year. So basically, both teams did that, or both leagues did that equally. Equally. So that's not a National League strategy. It's just a Major League strategy. Teams did it more than others, but one league did not really do it more than the other.
And it seems, again, it gets back to it's easier to hit and run or it's easier to implement these strategies when you have a guy who's accustomed to handling a bat.
You know what American League team actually offset this? Well, offset it the most was Oakland, which is no surprise. But you know what you know what other team really did not swing with the runner in motion much?
I would have to say Toronto.
Kansas City.
No, not Kansas City, small ball.
Near the bottom of the league in swings with the runner going. Now, maybe that's because they trust their runners to steal the bases.
Right.
But it's Kansas City, not a fan of the hit and run. Not the old National League style ball that we always hear about. Also, third stat I've got here, double steals. American League 46, National League 37. So double steal is more common in the American League than National League.
With the National League, there's certainly more substitutions and defensive substitutions, obviously, because you're bringing in people late. You don't have to worry about the defensive substitutions are usually a part of a double switch, though.
Yeah.
So that you can get that bat into the lineup for the last, you know, inning or whatever without having to have the pitcher lead off. But it, for me, it's not a matter of is it better for the NL to have a DH. I personally like the increased offense over the automatic out. But at the same time, I just want the teams to play on the same playing field. And that's not happening right now.
Right.
And I want what's best for the Braves. And having Ramiro Pena instead of David Ortiz is not best for the Braves.
Yeah, and I know my statistics kind of made it sound like American League's way was better. And in ways, it is. But it's I don't necessarily prefer that either. I can understand the wanting the same rules in both leagues argument because it just makes sense if you're designing a sport. Write one set of rules and have everyone play right by them.
One of the other arguments for the DH is that the game was originally designed for nine players. You play the field, you hit, you run, you throw the ball. But if we're going to go back to the original rules of the game, how far back do we go? Do we start counting balls that leave the field of play as outs?
Right.
Are we allowed to start pegging the runner and drilling him with the ball between first and second, although some probably deserve it? You know, do we have to go back to the days of scoring 21 aces to win the game rather than playing nine innings? You know, the game has always evolved. The game has always changed. In the original rules, African Americans were not allowed to play the game. At what point do you say, okay, we'll use these original rules, but not these original rules?
Right.
One of the other arguments also that there's a gentleman by the name of Toby Ramsey who links a lot of Braves articles, does a great job providing information for Braves fans on a lot of Facebook groups. And he and I got into a little discussion a few days ago. And Toby, it's not personal. You and I just differ on it. I love what you do, though. But one of his arguments, and it's arguments I've seen elsewhere, is that, okay, well, what happens? Why the pitcher? Why not have a DH for everybody? Why not have a DH for a weak-hitting infielder? Well,
I believe you can.
No, not currently. You can only use a DH for a pitcher in the AL. So one of the arguments, though, is, well, where does it end? Where does it end? Well, it ends where the rule says it ends. You just write it into the rule who you can use a DH for, and boom, it's done. So if you want to have the DH available for pitchers only, you write the rule that says the DH is available for pitchers only, like it is now. What I would like to see is if the DH is adopted, I wouldn't mind seeing a manager have the option of using a DH for a position player. If my option is to have Paul Janish a few years ago, Paul Janish for the Braves, whatever the hell his pronunciation
is. Janish, yeah.
Great defensive shortstop.
Yeah.
Can't hit a lick. Can't hit a lick. But he's a guy that if I'm in a playoff game, I wouldn't mind. I'll take the automatic out if I can have his glove out there.
Mm-hmm.
Another great example, the game from hell, Brooks Conrad and his three errors in the playoffs. You know, we talked about Brooks Conrad should never have been out there. Injuries led to it. But that's a perfect example of where we could have used Brooks Conrad's bat as a DH.
Mm-hmm.
And we could have stuck Deory Hernandez out there to field. And that's a great example of something that's not allowed now because, A, we don't have the DH, and, B, because the DH can only be used for a pitcher.
Yeah.
I think a manager should be given the option of using it for a position player if he wants. But those are things that, you know, just quick ideas off the top of the head that you know, the league's going to have to deal with if they want to implement it.
By the way, that's now two out of three podcasts in which we've already mentioned Brooks Conrad and Deory Hernandez. So, sorry about that, Braves fans.
Yeah.
We're going to stop talking about that, hopefully, by the time the new park opens.
But the DH, it's something that's being considered to increase offense. Is it coming to the NL? I think it will be here. I think you, as a matter of fact, I spoke with somebody last night who remembered a conversation you had a couple of years ago where you said, I think it was almost 3 years ago, 3 years ago now, you said that the DH will be in the NL within 5 years. And that's right on target with the 2017.
I think that'll be wrong. I think it'll be longer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's being pushed off. There's a lot of fan pushback, and baseball, you know, sometimes they do things the right way, sometimes they do things the wrong way, but they do listen to the fans. They don't necessarily always do what the fans want, but they do listen. I mean, you know, the fans are a reason that the money is just unheard of in the game right now.
Yeah. And I have a couple of thoughts. First of all, was the slippery slope argument of the, well, if we let, you know, where does it end? That argument.
The anarchy.
Yeah. The slippery slope argument is always a good scare tactic, but it's not realistic because you don't need shortstops as a position are not automatic outs. They're not, or at least relative to...
To pitchers.
To pitch, or no, at least relative to good average major league hitters. Pitchers are automatic outs compared. They're significantly worse as a group.
The worst hitters overall, and we're talking about as a group, the worst hitters are significantly better than the best pitchers.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not realistic to expect having seven DHs in a lineup at one point. It's just not realistic. I mean, sure, it's possible because robots playing baseball is possible too, but it's not a next step. It's not a logical next step. If you went with the DH in the National League, that's where it stops. That's where it stops for probably 50 years. And you can reevaluate at some point if for some reason shortstops become so dedicated to the defensive side of the game that they neglect offense completely in the way that pitchers do now, then maybe you talk about that at some point. But that's not a realistic discussion to have right now because it's just not on the table. No one's talking about it, and it's silly. The other thing I was going to mention is that, you know, even though the stats I mentioned earlier were they seem pro DH, I don't have a problem with someone not wanting the DH, and I don't necessarily want it. I don't quite know how I feel on it. I kind of go back and forth.
That's the way I am.
And
the only reason I want the DH is solely to make my team
right.
competitive with the guys they're going to face in the World Series. As far as regular everyday watching,
I definitely wanted it when we had Evan Gattis, and we traded Evan Gattis, and now I'm thinking, I can wait. I can wait now. We don't have eight hitters,
right? Let alone a ninth.
Yeah, the Braves don't really have eight good hitters right now. So
it'd be interesting to see. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the next collective bargaining agreement. It expires December 2016, so it expires at the end of the year. The DH is probably going to be discussed, as is the mound and the strike zone and other things. The players over the years, these large contracts that we've seen signed this year, notwithstanding, the players are making actually less money now as a percentage than have been in the past. Player revenue has dropped consistently for about the last 15 years, and the players are getting a smaller part of the pie than they had been. So what's happening is the billionaire owners are getting richer, and the players, despite getting more money, are getting less. What's happened is, with the exception of a very few top shelf guys like the David Prices and the Clayton Kershaws and those guys, the really top stars are getting a little bit more money. Mm-hmm. But their increase in pay is slight compared to the increase in pay being seen by the 50% of the middle guys who are your infielders who aren't stars. Those guys who had been making major league minimums of $3 million a year are now getting, you know, the Nick Markakis is a good example. You know, he's getting $11 million a year now, which probably was in years past would have been, you know, $7
million? Yeah.
Something like that, for the simple reason that there's more money to go around now. And that has nothing to do with attendance, and, well, a little bit to do with attendance. Most of it is driven solely by media markets. But you're going to hear more about the DH because it's going to become a stance in the collective bargaining agreements, but baseball is going to probably work it out. There had been some talk about a work stoppage. I think there's just too much money right now for them to worry about a work
neither
stoppage.
Neither side can afford to walk away from that.
So we'll see how the DH plays out.
Yeah.
But the Players Association is going to kind of talk it up a little bit. A lot of people think that the Players Association is for the DH because, oh, that's more guys. Rosters aren't going to expand. Rosters are still going to remain at 25 players. So the same number of players are still going to be paying the same dues.
Right.
So the Major League Baseball Players Association isn't going to get any more money. Although older, aging players with declining skills are probably going to push out up-and-coming guys who need a little bit of work.
All right, so stay tuned on the DH, and it'll be revisited next offseason, I'm sure. All right, well, we've got a little bit of time left, and
While we're talking about the DH, let's give you... I know you have been asking me some trivia the last couple of weeks, so we're going to go the other way, and I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, if I can remember what the question was. There are five pitchers, actually four pitchers, with a minimum of 500 career plate appearances.
Okay.
So, 500 career plate appearances, pitcher OPS over 550 when they have played, these guys have played since 1980.
Okay.
So their career may have started before 1980, but they at least played into the 80s, 90s, whatever.
Okay.
So four guys, career OPS of 550 or better.
Mm. And
into the 80s.
I believe Rick Rodin is one.
Rick Rodin had a career OPS. He was generally considered a very good hitting pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
Had a nice swing that has actually translated pretty well to I believe he's actually on the seniors golf tour now.
Nice.
He's actually, he wins a lot of Pro-Am golf tournaments now. 576 OPS for Rick Rodin.
Okay. I don't know who else to guess here. Mike Hampton.
Mike Hampton is the leader among this group with a 650 OPS. So he's actually he's comparable to Rafael Bellier.
Yeah, he hits like a shortstop, second baseman, a backup. Okay, so what about Zach Greinke?
He is not on that list, but he I think has not garnered enough plate appearances because half of his career.
Oh, in the American League. American League. What about Madison Bumgarner?
He has not gotten the plate appearances, but he would be on the list.
Carlos Zambrano?
Carlos Zambrano, 636 nice. Career OPS.
Yeah. So that doesn't even count the water coolers that he demolished as well.
He hits those well. It's like a fat fastball.
Okay. Who else? National League pitcher who can hit.
Is this where I insert the... Jose Reyes joke now?
Do I need to go through... do I need to go through the... Maddox, Glavin, Smoltz?
No. This one is going to be a guy who didn't get into the 90s. I don't think he got into the 90s.
Didn't get into the 90s. I don't.
Primarily an NL guy. He may have even been NL his whole career. Associated with one team primarily.
What?
May have even thrown a no-hitter.
May have thrown a no-hitter. That is a long list.
Kemper, his brother. I always mix them up.
Joe Niekro?
No.
Phil Niekro?
No.
Okay.
This is a 557 OPS, so he just made the cut.
All right, I'm gonna need the team.
Cardinals.
Is it
pick the right one.
John Tudor?
No. I think it's the Cardinals.
Bob Tewksbury. Is it him?
No, not Bob Tewksbury, but you were on the right track.
Oh, did Bob Gibson's career last till the 80s? I don't think so.
No, it did not.
Okay.
While you're thinking on
the
that,
Forsh
to get back to
brothers? Ken Forsh? Bob Forsh?
Bob Forsh, 557.
Nice.
So, yeah, the list of accomplished pitchers for a career.
Is that it? Is that the whole list?
Is not, yes, it is.
Okay.
Is not very, I mean, there are some outliers, but as a whole, pitchers are not very good hitters.
Right.
So, God, there
Bob
you go.
Forsh. Was Ken also a pitcher?
Yes, he was.
Okay.
One of the Forsh brothers threw a no-hitter. I just don't remember which one it was.
Nice. Okay. So. All right. Well, it's good that we actually talked for a while on the DH. So, but we still want to talk a little bit about the state of first base, which is it's good that it's going on to the end of this podcast because first base there's not a ton to talk about. We'll do what we did with catchers. We'll do a player by player look, and there's only five names really on the Braves first base depth chart.
So depth in first base in the Braves organization is not a strength.
No, but there are some interesting players here. So we'll start with Freddie Freeman. We know what he is.
He's a known commodity. Yeah. I expect Freeman to have a pretty good year this year. There are some who thought he had a bad year last year. I don't understand how they got this idea that he had a bad year. His numbers, his counting numbers were low because he got far fewer plate appearances than he typically does. He's normally around 630, 660 plate appearances. I think he finished around 480 for the year.
I think he played, 112 games last year?
He just didn't get the games. Yeah. I think they rushed him back from the injury because they were in the middle of that summer swoon. They were just skidding all over the place. Fans were bailing out on the games, and they needed to get something to oh, Freddie's coming back. Let's everybody show up and welcome Freddie back. But he was brought back too soon.
His power was improved last year. I think we've talked about this off mic, and think he would have probably finished with 25, 26 home runs.
Yeah, he would have been close to setting a
if he played as much as normal. So, it was a good. I'm very pleased with his performance. I think the batting average is down a little bit, but that may be related to just offensive trends in general in baseball over the last few years. So, right. I still think he has the upside of around a 300 hitter with 20 to 25 homers each year, and I think he'll age well. And I think I'm very glad that we looked this up before we started. I'm glad the Braves have him for 6 years, including 2016. 6 years, $118.5 million for ages 26 through 31.
Which
and that's
is,
a good deal.
You know, when you look at what the market looks like it's setting for top one-third hitters, that's a bargain.
Yeah.
You know, even the last couple of years of the deal in his age 30 and 31 seasons, you know, that's 2 years at $44 million. Mm-hmm. I'd pay that for a Freddie Freeman. Assuming this is the Freddie Freeman, you know, that doesn't fall off a cliff and he's doing what he's doing now, there's no reason not to get that.
Especially when a half good, like a really good half year just got Yoenis Cespedes $27.5 million for 1 year, basically.
Right. And that kind of brings up a question that was asked by Robert Porter. From I believe he's from the Greater Atlanta area. He's mm-hmm. asked us some questions before.
Yeah, he hangs on East Atlanta Village. So yeah, I've seen him there.
He asked, you know, can you justify trading Freddie Freeman after this season? As we had mentioned in a previous podcast, and you know, justify it, is it something I would like to see done? No, but you know, Freddie's making $12 million right now, and that jumps up rather significantly to $20 million, 20.5, I think, as a matter of fact, after this season.
You can definitely justify it because if you receive a good enough offer, you can justify trading Mike Trout, Bryce Harper. You can trade anybody in the game if you get enough in return. But
who are you going to replace him with is the question.
Yeah, first base to me is I've noticed in recent years, it's kind of like quarterback in the NFL, which is when you've got one, whether or not he's the best or not, when you've got one, you've got to sign him and you got to keep him because they're hard to find. Good first basemen are just hard to find, and teams don't let them go. Joey Votto, Paul Goldschmidt, Anthony Rizzo, these guys are not going places. They're going to be locked in with their teams because first basemen tend to stay good more than other positions, like a quarterback would in the NFL, and they tend to be your best hitter a lot of the time. I don't know if Freeman is necessarily always going to be our best hitter, but he's going to be one of our two best.
Right.
And so he's it's very valuable. It's still valuable to have him even at $20-plus million because it's just you're replacing it. You think back to the dark ages before Freeman when it was
Scott Thorman.
Adam LaRoche was pretty good for us for a few years, but, you know, bringing in Ken Caminiti to play first base. I mean, Julio Franco, I loved Julio Franco, but we signed a 47-year-old out of the Mexican League to come play first base in the majors for us. That's you don't want to be in the position where you have to do that.
Trading Freeman is something that got a lot of talk this offseason. Fans were losing their minds a lot of times over it. The Braves have decided that Freeman is the face of the franchise, and that he's the only player that the Braves have specifically used the words, we will not trade him. Yeah. Not, we haven't talked about it. Not, we haven't had discussions. Not, well, nothing is imminent. They tacitly said, we will not trade him. They never used those words on any of the other guys that they traded, even with Craig Kimbrell. John Hart never said, we're not trading Craig Kimbrell. He said, we have no plans to trade him. That was in November.
Plans change.
Plans changed. They came back. They were offered a great deal. Even when he said, oh, I see Craig Kimbrell closing out a World Series, he never said closing out a World Series for Atlanta. Words have meanings, and they're
also
used very specifically.
I also don't think that I think that basically the guarantee that we won't trade Freeman really doesn't extend past opening day of this year because there's more data, and you can't expect the team to say something in December of 2015 and then despite more data coming in over the next year to not change their stance.
Right.
Now, I mean, I'm not saying they will trade Freeman, but I'm saying that if Freeman has an outlier season where he bats 350 with 35 home runs or whatever,
and some
team offers us their entire farm system, you maybe take it because you don't expect him to continue that. By the same token, if he bats 220 and has, you know, 12 home runs and it's a bad season and somebody comes calling, then maybe you jump on that too. I'm just saying that more information doesn't mean you have to stick to... You don't have to stick
to
your
old... static for the entire remainder of the player's career.
Right. Okay. Now let's look at the depth at first base. Triple-A first baseman looks
Julio,
like
it's... No, wait. That would be Joey Turner. No. Who's the first baseman?
All right. We signed this guy this offseason. His name is Nate Freeman. Played a couple years with Oakland. He is a 6'8", 260-pound behemoth who is 29 years old. If I recall correctly, in 2011, 2012 in the minors, he was just crushing the ball. Hit 24 home runs, I think, in 2012 in the minors. That was at maybe Double A or Triple A. Came up 2013 with the A's, 2014 with the A's, and I don't know what he did last year, but Freeman, which is spelled differently, Braves fans.
Yeah, I was about to say, he's a...
F-R-E-I-M-A-N.
With a little heart over the I.
Yeah, we can call him Fryman, if that's easier, because we already have a Freeman. Nate Fryman doesn't do a lot well. He's 6'8" and 260, so he's probably not a graceful defensive first baseman. He's not a great overall hitter, but there's one thing he does really well, and that is crush left-handed pitching. Unfortunately, because the Braves are a National League team where you need defensive versatility and
no
you
DH.
Can't really afford to have a platoon partner for your first baseman, Freeman probably is not going to make the team this year.
Who's also a left-hander.
But in his major league career, he's batted .279 with a .326 on base and a .470 slugging against... left-handed pitching. The guy can hit lefties. Think the way Matt Diaz used to, but the difference is Matt Diaz could also a little bit hit righties. Nate Freeman, Fryman, cannot hit righties at all. And so he would be a strict pinch hitter against lefties or a first base platoon partner for Freeman. And you got to think the platoon side that faces lefties is probably only going to play
25 games.
Yeah, it's not 40. That many. It's not a ton. So if you were a platoon partner for Freddie, I'm not saying they would get equal playing time. Freddie would get the lion's share, and you'd bring in Freddie every game, basically, as a defensive replacement that Fryman started. I like this, calling him Fryman. But
Freddie's not going to get any platoons.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't mind seeing him getting a few more days off to keep him fresh throughout the year.
And when I say platoon, that's basically what I mean. I mean, this guy would come in when the Braves were facing a top lefty. Let's say, who's one of the best? Clayton Kershaw pitching against the Braves. Freddie's probably not going to do a lot with Kershaw that day. That's a good day for Freddie to have a day off and Nate Fryman to come in and see what he can do.
Right.
But he's not going to be on the roster probably, but he's a guy who is... waiting in the wings if there's an injury to Freddie. And I don't know. He may have an opt-out.
He's also not a big prospect. I mean, he's 29 years old.
Yeah, no, he's
so
not a prospect at all.
He was looks like he was drafted first over round two, pick one. That's mm-hmm. what it was. So it was a Rule 5 draft back in 2012 as well. He's depth.
Yeah.
He replaces effectively Tardoslavich or...
He's interesting depth, but he's just...
Right.
Okay. Next guy on the list is a guy named Jacob Schrader. He played at High A Carolina last year.
We have to go down to High A to find another first baseman.
Yeah, I think he's slated to be Double A first base this year. He is already 25. Well, he's going to be 25 on opening day. Has yet to play in Double A, I believe. Last year batted .268, .313 on base, and a .477 slugging. So he's got some pop. I think he's got maybe 15
ISO around 200.
Yeah, that's so. Not bad. That's pretty good. It's up there with Fryman. And But the one thing that stands out to me with Schrader is 103 strikeouts and 19 walks. He's I don't think the hit tool will carry him to the majors.
He has an above average rating, you know, WRC plus for his 3 years in the minors, a 92, a 127, and a 128. Those are good solid numbers. But his K rates are high.
He's old for the level too.
Yeah, his K rates are 27. 23, 25. Walk rates are all below average.
Yeah.
He's a guy who probably would be a DH somewhere, maybe even a platoon DH, but he's not going to be in our future plans too much.
I don't think he's in any team's future plan. I just don't think when you're striking out that much at single A as one of the oldest players in the league, then you're not going to...
Yeah, he was picked 27 in round 27, so he's not... He's not lighting anything up.
He's not a prospect. The last two are kind of interesting. The next name on the list is Carlos Castro, who will be 21 this season. He started off as a catcher. He has interesting batting average numbers, I believe. Last year at rookie ball, Danville, he batted .319 with a .340 on base. So it's mostly batting average driven. And a .412 slugging, which isn't amazing, but so some doubles.
WRC plus. Yeah, he's
putting some balls in the gaps.
It was a pretty high. He didn't have a too terribly high ISO. It was only a .093 ISO. So, you know, he's a single double hitter.
Mm-hmm.
But singles doubles hitters are effective if they can get on base.
Also, isolated slugging. Slugging is just, they don't manifest at ages, you know, 19, 20 years old.
Right. They just haven't filled out physically.
Most players aren't power hitters at that age. So, you're looking more for just broad skills.
Right, and one interesting, you know, to get back to one bright spot about him, the last 3 years, his batting average the last 3 years, as his playing time has increased, .221, .308, .319.
Yeah.
So as he's seeing pitchers, he's progressing. He's getting better with his batting average. His walk rates are not good. He doesn't draw walks. He doesn't strike out a lot. You know, his strikeout rate is probably just slightly below league average. Walk rates are well below league average, so he's a guy who's driven by his ability to put the ball in play.
They've been taking their time with him, too. This is his fourth year in rookie ball, I believe. So there's some, I don't know, I was looking at him and I thought there's some offensive upside here. He's too early to be calling him a prospect, really, a real prospect.
He's maybe a Darren Erstad type, a guy who... a first baseman who slaps the ball around. You know, he doesn't have the power to knock it out the park too much. I mean, he's got a few home runs, but he'll hit gap-to-gap power.
Yeah, he's interesting. Another guy that's interesting is Juan Yepes. He will be 18 this season. He started off as a third baseman. We signed him as a third baseman. There were immediate doubts as to whether... and he actually may still be playing third base, but there were immediate doubts when we signed him as to whether he would remain at third. He's a good enough arm. I think he's somewhat large, or maybe it's just mobility, maybe an issue where 6'1", they thought
200. He's not terrible.
Yeah, so he's not too big necessarily, but he's most scouts thought he'd be a better fit at first base, and maybe that's speaking more about his offensive ability. Seems to be a good power prospect with a good arm. Can definitely put the bat on the ball a little bit because last year, as a 17-year-old in rookie ball, and granted it's rookie ball, but 17 is still young for rookie ball. Batted .306, .402, .449 slugging at Danville.
And that was with only one home run. He's slapping doubles all over the place.
Nine doubles and 112 plate appearances or something like that. 13% walk rate as a 17-year-old is good to see. And now, granted, rookie ball, pitchers are a little wilder down there.
Right.
But also, hitters are generally more aggressive, though. So for him to be holding back and to be getting on base over 40% of the time, that's impressive. Juan Yepes is an interesting player that had a good, you know, there wasn't a lot of prospect hype around him. But when guys bat like this for their, you know, first couple of years, that's where the prospect hype builds from. So I think there's potentially a prospect here.
He reminds me a lot of the catcher we talked about, Rodriguez, from the Padres, the 17-year-old. That there's not a lot of info on them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a chance to see one of the games nearby, go check them out because nobody knows anything about these guys. And this is a guy you might want to file away, not because he may turn into something. It's because nobody knows, and with a break here and a break there, he can suddenly be a highly ranked prospect. You know, he can be the next, you know, Jose Peraza or Ozzy Albies or, you know, whoever. He could also turn into nothing. Nobody knows.
Yeah, it's too young.
But you know, write his name down and just kind of track him, because in a year or two, he may suddenly be at Double A at 19 years old, knocking on the door with a lot of power, or he could just be a washout. But that's one of the interesting things about all the prospects we've developed over the years, or acquired over the last year and a half, is just seeing which ones develop and which ones don't. You know, they're not all going to work out. But if you like baseball, you get into this sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think Yepes could make his he might play for Rome this year. I don't know. They may want a full season, more time at Danville. They did that with Castro. They played him in rookie ball for years. But I don't know. It's interesting. Yepes is an interesting player that I'm going to keep my eye on. I don't – probably not a top 20 prospect for Atlanta, but he's maybe a top 20 offensive prospect for Atlanta, because –
I wouldn't put that. Well, that's because we have
take out all the pitchers.
Yeah, so yeah, that's possible. So, but that list kind of shows us that there's not a lot waiting in the wings behind Freddie Freeman. So the idea of trading Freddie Freeman really means even less now.
And also, you never. Most teams don't have a lot of great prospects at first base. Most players aren't.
Don't come up as first baseman.
Right. They don't come up as first baseman. Usually your first baseman came up as third baseman. Jim Thome was a third baseman coming up.
I think Thome was actually a catcher coming up.
Oh, he might have gone from catcher to third.
Right.
Yeah, and he was a third as a rookie in the big leagues. And Jason Giambi, third. You got a lot of great first basemen come from other positions. So,
and that's kind of where we are. If it came to it, and for some reason, Freddie Freeman was no longer able to continue, whether it be an extended injury, you know. And, you know, in 2018, Freddie Freeman has a season-ending injury. Who's going to be our first baseman then?
Hector Oliveira.
If not Oliveira, then, you know, we might see Braxton Davidson at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, Davidson and Austin Riley are probably the two guys in the system right now who could be slid over to first base if they were needed to fill a spot. You obviously want to let each of them continue to develop where they are, you know.
Right, and so we'll be covering Riley on third base and Davidson in the outfield, but it's the guys we listed today are not the only guys capable of being first base down the road.
They're just the guys playing first base in the system right now.
Or at least the guys that we are pretty sure will definitely win. Like, I think Yepes is still at third, but it's enough. There's enough certainty that he'll be at first that you can go ahead and pencil him in as a first base prospect.
Right.
But anyway, that's a quick look at the Braves' first base situation, and which compared to other situations, pretty good, because we got Freddie Freeman, perennial All Star caliber player, and at least there are some interesting players in the system. But I think that's
any other news.
I think that's it. That's all for today. Thank you for listening, and subscribe to us on iTunes.
Check us out at outfieldflyrule.com.
I think that's it.
Facebook. You'll know the names. I'm usually the one arguing with everybody.
Yeah, and I'm the one trying to bring peace and wind up arguing. So, thanks, and goodbye.
Have a good day.